rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on terrestrial radio stations, on Sirius satellite radio, on CRN Digital, and beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live365's American FM. Welcome to our program. The terror suspect gets a dinner invitation. There's really a larger frame for this. This story about, there's this guy, Saeed Masoud, who was, before 9/11, a big supporter of George W. Bush. He's a Muslim businessman here in the United States. And he was giving money to the Republicans. And then 9/11 happens, and they decide, maybe, you know, this guy's a Muslim. This happened in Germany, too. They went nuts after going after people of Middle Eastern ancestry. In Germany, it was the Jews. Here, it's the Muslims. But, you know, it's obviously there are some very significant differences. We have not yet started death camps, but we do have 6 concentration camps. And there is this persecution happening. And so this guy was one of them. They kicked in his door. They took apart his house. And nowadays, he says he's lucky to get on an airplane without being detained and searched. He's on the do not fly list, and he's been trying to get off it. And then he gets a letter in the mail. You, Mr. Masoud, are invited to serve as an honorable chairman at President George W. Bush's dinner, a Republican fundraiser in Washington, D.C. next month. Because you are a Republican who has donated significant money to previous GOP campaigns. Well, needless to say, Mr. Masoud said, no, I think not. I'll pass. Although he still says he supports President Bush. He says, I think he's a really good guy. Well, if you're a Muslim businessman in the United States right now, and you don't say that, you may end up in Guantanamo Bay. You have to wonder, you know, to what extent this guy is speaking his real opinions. But the larger issue, and I think perhaps the more important issue that this raises, is the war on terrorism. Is this war on terrorism a phony thing? If you've got a guy who's on the do not fly list, he's presumably a terrorist, or at least a suspected terrorist, enough so that the FAA has gone through the trouble of putting him on this list, Department of Homeland Security. If you've got a guy who's that problematic, why are you inviting him to be the host of a dinner for George W. Bush? Well, because he's got some money. And then that raises the question, well, is there really a terror threat to America that's worth bringing down American democracy, that's worth giving up our civil rights, that's worth changing our form of government over? Which takes us back to this movie, this 3-hour documentary that I so strongly recommended back last October when it first played on BBC, called The Power of Nightmares. The Power of Nightmares chronicles the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I don't know if you noticed, but over the weekend, I believe it was over the weekend, it might have been Friday of last week, but anyhow, very recently, in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood was busted in Egypt, and they caught a bunch of their guys, and I believe a couple of them were killed. The Muslim Brotherhood was started by a guy who was living in St. Louis, Missouri, who was living in the center of the United States. He was an exchange student from Egypt. And he, at the same time that the father, Leo Strauss, the father and founder of the whole neocon movement, was teaching at the University of Chicago, at the same time, these two guys were saying essentially the same thing. Strauss was saying, American culture has become corrupt. People are too into materialism. They need to turn back to their religious roots. They need to turn back to fear and respect of government. And the only way to make this happen is to lie to them, and that's acceptable. In fact, that's desirable if those lies help strengthen the power of government and turn people back in a moral direction. That was Leo Strauss's, you know, the ends justify the means, which we saw the Bush administration playing out. We've seen it in several different arenas. We see the lies being told right now about the filibuster. Orrin Hatch from Utah now saying just a day or so ago on the floor of the Senate and saying on TV that the filibuster of Abe Fortas was not the first, was not the last time that a filibuster of a nominee was before the Senate, that he wasn't really filibustered. Well, he was really filibustered. So then Hatch says, well, he really wouldn't have had a majority. Well, it turns out he would have had a majority. John Dean, the former lawyer, White House counsel for Richard Nixon in FindLaw.com, wrote a brilliant piece about this over the weekend, in which he goes back to the historical record and lays it all out. Yes, the Republicans did filibuster Abe Fortas. No, they did not allow him to sit as Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. It was a successful filibuster against a judicial nominee, against LBJ's judicial nominee. Period. And he did have the support of the majority of the United States Senate. In fact, John Dean is coming out and asking Orrin Hatch, well, actually, he rhetorically asked the question, is he misinformed or is he a liar? And I would say that after John Dean has written this piece, Orrin Hatch can no longer claim he's misinformed. So I guess if he continues saying this, or any other Republicans continue saying this, that it's unprecedented, that it's never happened before, that the Republicans would never do this, that they are liars. Because one of their own, John Dean, the former lawyer to Richard Nixon, has come out and said, hey, we filibustered this guy. And we were successful, and the Democrats controlled the Senate, and they would have gone along with it. They would have put Abe Fortas in, but the Republicans filibustered him. And what was Abe Fortas' crime? Abe Fortas' big crime, well, he had two big crimes that caused the Republicans to filibuster him. One, he voted that pornography may be protected under certain circumstances. They exempted things like child pornography, but the pornography may be exempted from the purview of the morality police who want to use government to enforce their private morality because it's protected by the First Amendment. It's protected free speech. You may not like it, but it's somebody's opinion of something. So that would number one. And number two, and perhaps most importantly, in the 1967 case came before the Supreme Court about whether or not a state could forbid the teaching of evolution. Abe Fortas wrote the majority opinion for the court, which said that no, a state cannot forbid the teaching of evolution. It's science. It has to be in science classes. So they filibustered him. And you got this brilliant piece by John Dean this weekend talking about this. So the point of all of this, where I'm going with this whole thing, is that there is this larger issue of, is there really a war on terrorism? Is there really a danger to America, or is it just, you know, a relatively small thing? Was Al-Qaeda taking out the towers? I mean, this was 19 guys with box cutters. We're nowhere near living with the kind of terror that England lived with the IRA back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. We're nowhere near what Spain went through with the Basque separatists. We're nowhere near what Italy went through with the Red Brigades. Killing the Prime Minister, Aldo Moro. We're nowhere near what Greece went through with November 27, their terrorist group. We're nowhere near what Israel has gone through with the terrorists who are coming after them. I mean, we're not even close to any of this stuff, and none of those countries, by and large, have seen fit to end civil liberties, to suspend habeas corpus, to build concentration camps. Well, there have been a few violations of civil rights, shall we say, certainly among that whole bunch. Probably I should have just stuck with England. But or Germany, the Bader-Meinhof gang, or Italy with the Red Brigades. I mean, the point is that these countries said, okay, there's people, they call themselves terrorists, they're criminals. We're going to go after them, we're going to take them out as criminals, and we're going to let law enforcement do that. The Bush administration instead has said, oh, no, we've got to have Super George. George Jr. was viewed as a wimp. He was viewed as a pretender to the throne. He was viewed as he was installed by his daddy's handpicked Supreme Court and his brother's rigged election in Florida. He had no legitimacy, and so he needed to have an uber enemy. He had to have an enemy who was so powerful that he could be the counter enemy. Karl Rove understood very well the lesson of fiction. Bob McKee, Robert McKee, who wrote the book Story and teaches workshops on this stuff all over the world, one of the most brilliant speakers and writers and thinkers these days on how to put together a novel, how to put together story, said in a workshop. I've attended his workshop, and he said, Superman without Lex Luthor would be the most boring story ever told. You got a super guy, he's got all his skills, he can see through steel, he can fly faster than a bullet, he can leap over tall buildings. No crook can stand up to him, so all of a sudden, Metropolis is now crime-free. End of story. Who cares? This is not a story. In order to have a serious hero, you have to have a serious anti-hero. A hero is measured by the anti-hero. We remember Roosevelt because he had the Great Depression and he had Hitler. Without the Great Depression and without Hitler, Roosevelt would have just been another president who had some nice liberal ideas. Without the Civil War, Lincoln would have just been another good president, you know, or maybe not even. Without the Revolutionary War, George Washington would have been just another wealthy planter. He wasn't even all that wealthy. He couldn't even afford to free all his slaves when he died. He would have just been another slaveholder in Virginia. It's the anti-hero that makes the hero. And so here now you have the Bush administration whipping up these anti-heroes, taking a small terrorist group that didn't have popular support in the Arab world. In fact, they'd been kicked out of Saudi Arabia. Then they were kicked out of Sudan. And they finally were able to cut a deal with the most corrupt Arab government of all in Afghanistan to hang out there for a while. But even the Afghans were willing to give him up. After 9/11, you had the head of the Taliban saying, okay, we'll give you Osama if you want him. And we said, no, we don't want him. We want to have a war. And this is the serious question. And the fact that a guy who's on the do not fly list gets invited to be the chairman of the Bush fundraising dinner tells me that these guys are more interested in public perception than they are in actual war against terror. And maybe that's because the war against terror is just a bunch of nutty criminals, and really they should be best dealt with by Interpol, and that we do have it under control. And yeah, we'll probably be hit again. I mean, it happened to England and all those other countries, but why get hysterical about it? Well, because it helps George politically. He spreads terror and fear. And then it seems to work. 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
And welcome back, my friends. And all this raises the question, why would George W. want us to be terrorized? Why would he want to promote, essentially, a terrorist agenda? Well, because it takes our eye off the ball. It takes our eye off things like the corporatization of America, the rape of our communities by giant multinational corporations, the wiping out of all of our small and medium-sized businesses by giant multinational corporations, the giving away of American sovereignty to giant multinational corporations, the giving away of our natural resources to his buddies in the extractive industries, the oil, the gas, the mining industries, the multi-trillion-dollar transfer of wealth from the middle class and the working poor to the millionaires and billionaires among us, including those members of the Bush family and the Cheney family, and on it goes. And you want some evidence of this? Well, you'll recall last week we captured the number 3 guy in Al-Qaeda. Remember that? the number three guy in Al-Qaeda. Bush came out, George Bush. He says, this is a top general. I'm quoting, a major facilitator and chief planner for the Al-Qaeda network. Now, Condi Rice comes out, press conference, very important figure. Yes. Well, turns out the guy we got, Abdul Farak Al-Libi, spelled L-I-B-B-I, was not the number three man in Al-Qaeda. That's Anas El-Libi, L-I-B-Y. He's wanted over a 1998 East African embassy bombing, U.S. embassy. According to the Times of London, and I quote, the Americans may have initially confused the two when the Sunday Times contacted a senior FBI counterterrorism official for information about the importance of the detained man. He sent material on Al-Libi, Al-Libi, the wrong man. So who is the guy that they caught last week? And they've been telling the whole world, hey, this is it. We've got him. He's the kingpin, the number three guy. Turns out he made coffee and copies. He was no European or American intelligence expert contacted last week had ever heard of Al-Libi, L-I-B-B-I, the guy that we captured. A former close associate of bin Laden, now living in London, laughed. He said, quote, what I remember of him is he used to make the coffee and do the photocopying, end quote. They got the intern. They got the guy who was working for minimum wage in the office in London, the local Al-Qaeda office in London back before they were barred. Some believe Al-Qaeda. Now, I'm reading from the Times of London. This is a newspaper owned by Rupert Murdoch. Some believe Al-Libi's significance has been cynically hyped by two countries that want to distract attention from their lack of progress in capturing bin Laden, who has now been on the run for almost 4 years. Yeah, some put me in that list. One American official, again quoting from the Times of London, one American official tried to explain the absence of Al-Libi's, L-I-B-B-I's name, the guy they caught, his name isn't on any of the lists, on the wanted list, by saying, quote, we did not want him to know that he was wanted. You get that? We caught a guy who isn't, we say he's the number three guy, he's on all the lists. Well, no, another guy with a name L-I-B-Y, he's on the list. But this L-I-B-B-I guy, no, he's not on any lists. So they go to the Americans, the Times of London goes to the administration, our administration, your government and mine. And they say, well, why isn't this guy that you captured on any lists? Well, we didn't want him to know that he was wanted. Yeah. Bush called this, another Libyan on the is on the FBI list, Anas El-Libi, who is one, L-I-B-Y, and you got it. So, you know, it's like the Three Stooges run security. It's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. And then we get this leaked memo within MI6, which says that Bush and Blair had already decided that they were going to attack Iraq. They both thought there was some political juice to be made from it, not to mention a little oil in the bargain. And they had to cook the intelligence to go along with it. We'll get into that in your phone calls right after this. Our number 866-889-8894. Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Check your weapons at the door. You don't live here anymore.
One of these days soon, hopefully we can say that to George Jr. I really like calling him Junior now that I've discovered that he absolutely hates to be called Junior. I think it's important that we all start calling him Junior. Is that petty? Perhaps it is. I don't know. Anyhow, color me petty, I guess, in that case. What can I say? But they've full court press by the White House 4 years ago to stop any news agencies from referring to George Bush Jr. as Junior because he so dislikes his father that he's unwilling to be called Junior. And he picked, you know, he tried to beat up his father once, you'll recall. Go, let's go mano a mano over his drinking. Anyhow, welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. It is 25 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Chris in Abiquiu, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much. Yes, save the guy's feelings. Let's call him the Bush Baby or Ho-Ho the Sock Puppet. You would like those.
The I Sock suppose. Puppet. Why is it Dick Cheney can't drink water when George Bush is talking?
This is true. Just as an aside, apropos of nothing, how can you go to Europe to commemorate VE Day when your grandpa was one of Hitler's bankers? How do you do that?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It makes no sense. Going back to the filibuster.
And what's interesting is that you're the first person that I've heard in any media, Chris, and I confess to my own failing. I mean, I knew the whole story, and I didn't bring that up on this program, that has brought this up.
Well, Caustic is my middle name.
Yeah. But I would think that, you know, in some news report somewhere, somebody would have seen fit to point out that George Bush's grandfather
Prescott
Bush, was lost his bank over trading with the enemy act, and that Roosevelt took him out, and that it was covered in the New York Times. It was a major story that the former senator from Connecticut had lost his bank, his bank had gone down, and for trading with Hitler after it was illegal. And it was when the Bush family swore eternal vengeance on Roosevelt and the Democrats.
Well, at least Putin had the grace not to bring it up, right? You know, I mean,
when you got to look to Putin for grace, you're in deep trouble.
Going back to the filibuster stuff, you know, Abe Fortas, of course, you know, it speaks for itself. The way I'm arguing the whole thing lately, well, Rule 31, I'm not going to let that go. I mean, I think Rule 31 proves that the founders never intended an up or down vote on any nominee.
It came a little beyond the founders. It came about 30 years after the founders. But nonetheless, that early generation, yeah.
First of all, Frist does not have the votes. If Frist had the votes, they'd have done this already.
Let me just append one thing, Chris. When I said Rule 31 didn't come with the founders, before Rule 31 came along and before it was a two-thirds majority, which it was initially, and then around the 19-teens it became 60 votes. But back before it was a two-thirds majority, it took one senator. One senator could tie it up.
Well, yeah, but you're confusing two rules. You're talking about Rule 22, which is what the Republicans want to amend now, or re-amend now. I'm talking about Rule 31, rule of the Senate that says that if a nominee is not voted on up or down past a certain point,
it goes away. Yeah, okay.
Thanks
for correcting me.
There's no reason for that rule. You know, I mean, it gives lie to this up or down intention by the founders of the Senate. You know, in any case, as I said, Bill Frist does not have the votes, or this would have happened already. I don't think he's going to get the votes. But beyond Abe Fortas, just parliamentary procedure to block an up or down vote in the Senate has a long tradition, and the Republicans did it to Bill Clinton's nominees 60 times. Now, was it a filibuster? Perhaps not. But it was still parliamentary procedure to deny an up or down vote.
Sure.
And...
For 35% of his nominees did not make it through, whereas only 5% of Bush's nominees have not made it through.
Yeah, the fact is that their argument is completely bankrupt, and all we have to do is keep pointing it out, because I don't think they can win this one.
Yeah, well, from your lips to God's ears, Chris, I hope you're right.
Take care, man.
Yeah, thank you. Good to hear from you. Rick in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Rick.
Hey, that's a new one on me that Bush wanted to beat his father up once.
Oh, yeah. It's in several of the biographies of him. It's not anything that he denies. He came home drunk one night, and his father confronted him in the driveway, and he said, come on, let's go at it mano a mano, and tried to punch him.
My.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, getting back to this filibuster thing, I actually did not know. This previous caller brought something to my attention, too, and I knew what you said about the fact that one senator could tie it up. I think I brought that out one time when I called before, but I didn't realize that there's a rule that if an appointee is not voted on, they're supposed to just automatically go away.
Yeah, it is. It doesn't specify the time, as I recall, or
right.
It's the next session or whatever. But
well,
yeah.
Of course, the Senate was never meant to be a democratic institution, so, you know, small d. But getting back to this comment that Hatch made, I didn't hear it, but I'm kind of amazed when people on both sides of the aisle, as they say, well, this filibuster went on, but you know, there weren't enough votes. Well, here's the thing, and tell me if I'm missing something, Tom, but if one side filibusters, don't they only do that if the other side does have the votes?
Right, that's the only reason that you do a filibuster.
Why would you filibuster?
Right.
I mean, isn't that kind of a ludicrous statement?
Yeah, the filibuster is an effort by the minority to thwart the will of the majority. Very
simple.
When
they know they don't have the votes.
Right.
Now,
right.
That may sound undemocratic, but someone mentioned Putin. Did you catch his comments? I forget where I saw it. Maybe it was on Capital Gang over the weekend. I like to watch these shows. And Putin, I guess, was a little irritated by Bush kind of rubbing it in his nose about the Baltics. You know, I mean, after all, Mr. Putin, in all fairness, wasn't even born when all that happened.
What I thought was most interesting about the Bush-Putin thing was if you go to CBSNews.com, and go to the 60 Minutes site that they have there, they have a transcript of Mike Wallace's entire interview with Putin.
Okay.
And then if you saw it, the 60 Minutes last night.
I missed that.
Okay, well, you'd have to have seen it because they don't have the video of the program on. But what's interesting is that in the interview, this whole long interview that runs like 7 pages long on, you know, of web pages, it's probably,
right,
probably would print out to be like 10 or 15 pages. In the interview, several times when Mike Wallace tries to pin Putin down about, you know, is the press free, blah-de-blah, Putin throws it back at Mike Wallace and says, you know, we have a problem with our oligarchs here. There's these 20 rich guys, basically, in Russia who, when the state industries were privatized, they had figured out how to game the system, and they ended up, you know, one of them ended up owning Lukos, the oil, basically most of the oil industry. One of them ended up owning, you know, a lot of apartment buildings. Another one ended up owning, you know, the airlines and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he said, we've got a problem with this, with these oligarchs, and we need to deal with it. He says, however, you and your media, you have, you know, a handful of companies that control all of your media. You have an oligarchic system in the United States.
And
that didn't make it onto 60 Minutes.
Oh, surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Well, I remember the eminent historian Arnold Toynbee in a Playboy interview way back in about 1967. He felt that Russia, remember this is 1967, almost 40 years ago, he felt that Russia over time would become more like us and we would become more like them. But boy, he was really quite prescient.
Yeah.
But
unfortunately.
Yeah, one thing Putin said, though, he says, You know, he says, in this country, our president is directly elected. He says, we don't have an electoral college. And he says, in 2000, your judiciary interfered in the election. He says, we don't do that here either.
Right.
Boy, talk about rubbing the nose in it.
And then he says, but it's not my job to stick my nose into America's politics, and so I won't any further.
Well, he's just speaking the truth. In those two cases, he's simply speaking the truth.
Yeah, it was a remarkable interview. Although he then goes on to say that he likes George Bush and that he thinks he can trust George Bush and you know, all that kind of stuff. And that all made it into the 60 Minutes interview.
Well,
big time. In fact, it got featured in the 60 Minutes interview.
Well, they're actually a couple of thugs, so it's no wonder they get along.
Yeah, yeah. And George's daddy was head of the CIA and Putin was head of the KGB. I mean, it runs in the families.
Sure.
So, yeah, power knows power. Yeah, thanks a lot, Rick. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Armin in Florida and Sarasota on the line. Hey, Armin.
Can I jump around today, or you get really upset when I do that?
What I get upset with, Armin, is when people try and filibuster, when they try and take over the show. What's your point?
With your debate about the war on terror, that'd be the first thing that I'd want to talk about.
Okay, go for it.
I think that's pretty simple. All you got to do is look at PNAC, and when you see PNAC and their agenda, and then you see the so-called, I use those words, war on terror, you think, how better could you put icing on a cake?
Well, not only that, the PNAC folks said that in order for their policies to be advanced, for them to actually do what they want to do, they would have to have a Pearl Harbor-like event here in the United States. And surprise, surprise, they got one. They got one from the guy who's the brother of the businessman who bailed out George Bush Jr.'s business, Arbusto Oil Company, back in the 70s. They got one from the guy who's the son of the company that is the largest political donor or the largest, excuse me, financial business partner to George Bush Sr., the Bin Laden family and the Carlyle group. I mean, the guy is on the board.
It goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I mean,
okay,
they got it.
Next issue.
Yeah.
Next issue. And then there's one after that, if you allow me, sir. You're the boss. I'll, whatever you say. Okay? The next issue. Okay, I'm seeing the TV. It's going all through the media today. A fast food tax. my thing would be, comment on it is, my God, what do they want to do? Drive the last manufacturing jobs out of this country?
Now that they've determined that putting pickles on,
right,
on a burger is manufacturing. Do you know if that actually ever went through, Armin? I don't think they were successful. I think they just proposed that.
Well, they got Ronald Reagan on with their balloons, you know. You know, they put their balloons up with this newfound ways to extract capital for a select few. But
yeah.
Anyway.
I don't think they
went forward yet. But
yeah,
anyway.
So anyhow. Okay, so your final point.
Third issue. There's a big story today in the Wall Street Journal, and it's about the Department of Justice going after the National Association of Realtors.
Right.
Okay.
It's on the front page.
Because they stifle competition. Okay,
right, it's an antitrust action.
Okay, you never see them going after the AMA. You never see them going after the bar. And, you know, the Wall Street Journal, in my opinion, is nothing more, nothing less than pom-pom cheerleaders that are use situational application for the predatory capitalists.
Well, you're absolutely right with regard to the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. The reporting in the Wall Street Journal tends to be, in my experience, fairly stand-up. I believe that the AMA, just like national, I know that the national baseball, you know, the sports leagues have an exemption from the antitrust laws. And
okay.
I may be wrong about the AMA. In fact, my memory now serves me that the only official exemption is for the sports leagues. But it wouldn't surprise me if there's something at law that allows the AMA to not be prosecuted for antitrust violations.
And the bar. But
yeah.
But you don't see the Wall Street Journal going after them because, well, we won't get into
that. Well, the Wall Street Journal isn't going after anybody, Armin. They're reporting what the Justice Department's doing, that's all. And it's
pretty
straightforward reporting. You've read the article.
Well, now, Tom, you know how the media situationally omits the things they omit, and they go and they portray the things that they portray. And
I'm not here to tell you that
the Wall Street Journal
isn't part of the mainstream media. It's not Mother Jones, you know. It's not in these times. It's not good, unbiased reporting.
How much stuff do they not comment on that has a real dramatic economic impact on the middle class? So that says a lot about their, in my opinion, their intentions and their agenda and who they're loyal to. And
okay,
who they really
I got it, Armin.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
I appreciate that. And, you know, good point and point made. Although I would point out to you that the Wall Street Journal was the only newspaper that did a really good story, actually a whole series of stories, about the rationing of health care in the United States back last year that really made the Bush administration look bad. The Wall Street Journal was, here I am. I feel very uncomfortable being in the position of defending the Wall Street Journal. But I just have to say, of the mainstream media, I've been more disappointed in the reporting in the New York Times than in the Wall Street Journal, frankly. You know, for what it's worth. May or may not have any meaning or significance, but they are the capitalist tool. Of course, Dow Jones Corporation. It doesn't mean that they don't. I'm back to defending them again. Here's this letter that was sent to George W. Bush. Back to the issue of, you know, do we really have a war on terrorism, or is this just all about politics? This letter was signed by a whole bunch of members of Congress. I'm not going to read the list because the list would take the next 3 minutes of the show before we've got to take a break here. But, a long, long list. And the letter starts out, "We write because of troubling revelations in the Sunday London Times. This is the story that finally yesterday made a small Knight Ridder story in the United States. Back on Friday, you'll recall, and on Thursday I was saying, hey, this is screaming headlines in the UK. Why are no newspapers in the United States reporting on it? Well, finally, the Knight Ridder ran a small story that was picked up by a few local papers. Here in Portland, Oregon, it was picked up by the Oregonian yesterday, in which they say that, you know, hey, there was this memo which says that Bush was cooking the books on the intelligence because he'd already decided to go to war and Blair was going along with it. And so here now we have all these members of Congress signing this letter saying, you know, Prime Minister Tony Blair chaired a July 2002 meeting in which he discussed military options, having already committed himself to supporting Bush's plans for invading Iraq. British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw acknowledged that the case for war was thin, as Saddam was not threatening his neighbors, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran. A separate secret briefing for the meeting said that Britain and America had to create conditions to justify a war. A British official, quote, report on his recent talks in Washington, there was a perceptible shift in attitude. Military action was seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam. Though military action justified by the conjunction, through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. And so you've got a bunch of members of Congress who are coming forward, and they're saying to the president, to George W. Bush, in this written letter, hey, what's going on here? Did you really lie to us? Would you please reply to this? And Bush says, excuse me, I got to go to Russia and see my good friend Vlad. Is there a real war on terror, or is there just a show war on terror? Is it just a faux war on terror, like faux news? In my opinion, it is the whole thing, top to bottom, phony. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What a wonderful, wonderful world this could be.
If only the Republicans were out of power and we got back some rationality in government and the DLC was drummed out of the Democratic Party and some true progressives took over and Bernie Sanders got elected to the United States Senate and, you know, stuff like that. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Doug in Santa Fe listening to the program. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to add something to your discussion about is this a real war on terrorism or not. And that
sure.
is the terror alerts. As soon as the elections were over, we stopped hearing about them completely. So all those skeptics out there that believe that this is a real war, watch. As soon as 2006 starts rolling around the election time, they're going to roll those out again and scare the hell out of everybody.
Oh, yeah. And when you go back and you log, or you plot on a graph, or however you'd say it, the terror alerts being rolled out and bad news for the Bush administration making, you know, rising to the A-story level, you know, to the senior headlines, to the top headlines, you find that there's an absolute correspondence. Every time bad news was happening for the Bushies, particularly bad news that would reflect, you know, electorally, then the terror alert went up. And, you know, it was just so simple. It was so transparent. And people were pointing it out at the time. And, you know, I was pointing it out in this program. I mean, people were pointing it out. It was being pointed out even occasionally in the mainstream press. But it was small compared. You know, it was like this thing with Al Libby, where, you know, last week the big story was we caught the number three guy. This week, oh, he really wasn't the number three guy. Well, we caught the number three guy. That was the lead. You know, Wolf Blitzer led with that. That was the number one story on the news. Do you think anybody is going to report the fact that this guy actually ran the photocopy machine in the London Al-Qaeda office?
No, because even in, you know, my local newspaper, the New Mexican, when they make a correction, it's about an inch by inch.
That's right.
He's buried in the third or fourth page.
That's right. So they get tremendous mileage from lying to us. They get tremendous mileage from scaring us. And then when they get called on it, very few people notice. Very few people notice. So it's a tragedy for America. Doug, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing that out.
Have a good day.
Thanks. And thanks for listening to us there in Santa Fe and KRSN. I do appreciate it. So, you know, what are we going to do? What we have to do, very straightforward, very simple. Very simple, is get some statesmen and women in office instead of political hacks like Tom DeLay, Bill Frist, and oligarchs like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Let's bring democracy back to America and return this government back to we the people, the ones who started it, who said, hey, it's we the people creating this government. Not we the corporations, not we the wealthy few, we the people. We can do it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Increasingly embattled, the Tom DeLay Political Death Watch moves on. Increasingly embattled, DeLay scales back his usual power plays. In the euphemism favored on Capitol Hill, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay is not staff-driven. Translation, he's used to doing what he wants. All right, John Harris and Mike Allen in the Washington Post. For a full decade, the 58-year-old DeLay's career has prospered because he was usually right in his calculations. Apparently no more. Suddenly, they write, the old Texas brio that carried him through years of smaller controversies is on the wane. On the wane. The leader recognizes, belatedly, some GOP colleagues say, that the latest questions about his relationships with lobbyists are a problem threatening his career and the GOP majority that he helped to build and maintain. Everywhere, there are signs of a politician in retreat. DeLay's prowess in fundraising, for instance, was always a pillar of his power in the House. Lining up a corporate aircraft to ferry him to an event was usually arranged with a single phone call. These days, Republican officials report that they are having trouble finding available aircraft, as businesses fret that DeLay may be radioactive. DeLay, likewise, usually no longer attends joint news conferences of the GOP leadership. His presence, Republicans say, would distract from the party's message about gas prices or the topic of the day. Yeah. So, the DeLay Death Watch, Political Death Watch, continues. In the face of this, we have John Bolton. Now, you will recall that there was a bit of a controversy some time back about the uranium from Niger. Remember that? The old uranium in Niger story. It was a big story there, you know, for a while. There was the Bush administration was saying, oh, you know, we're definitely at risk here because Saddam has been trying to get uranium from Niger, and it's a terrible problem. We got to do something about it. And he built it, he put it in his State of the Union speech and the whole thing. And then Joe Wilson was hired by the CIA to go check it out, and he goes down there, and he used to be ambassador to that area, and he goes down, checks it out, and comes back and says, hey, nothing. Saddam didn't buy anything from them. And Bush goes ahead and talks about it anyway. So Joe Wilson writes an op-ed piece for the New York Times saying, why is our president lying to us? Could it be that he's trying to, well, this, Wilson didn't say this, I would say this, could it be he's trying to terrorize us? Who are the real terrorists anyway? Why is our president lying to us? And so when Bush is called on his lie, of course he does what the Bushies do. They lash out. I mean, you corner rats, they come at you, as Vlad Putin pointed out in his interview yesterday with Mike Wallace. You can read it on CBSNews.com. It's not the part of the interview that made the 60 Minutes show. But the actual interview itself is fascinating, where Putin is talking about how he learned as a child that if you corner a rat, it will come after you, and it'll actually chase you. So the Bushies cornered, chased back, and they went after Joe Wilson's wife. She was running an international CIA sting operation to bust people, to bust terrorists who were looking to buy weapons. And somebody outed his wife. Somebody brought down the entire operation. I'm telling you, if somebody in the Clinton administration had done this, Rush would still be talking about it. And they brought this whole thing down. And George W. has, of course, this to say about that.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official.
The leaker.
Now, this is a large administration. And there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah. I don't have any idea. Yeah. Oh, my. Well, here's where the story gets even more interesting. Nobody had asked the question before, where did that story come from that Joe Wilson debunked? that made its way all the way up into the State of the Union address? Where did the story come from? Who came up with the idea that Saddam was buying yellow cake uranium from Niger? Who might it have been? Who was the misguided person in the State Department or the CIA or in one of our intelligence agencies who came up with this idea for which there was no evidence other than a patently forged memo? It was an obvious forgery. A couple of the people whose names were on it were dead as of the time that it was supposed to have been published. It was so obviously a forgery that the CIA, when they got the thing, they didn't even bother to run it through any kind of a net. They just looked at it. This is a forgery. It came to us via England, who had labeled it a forgery. So who was behind this? Who forged the documents? Who provided the phony intelligence? Moondog in our chat room says Doug Feith's office forged the documents. Well, maybe. Here's a story you might find of interest. On December 19th, 2002, the State Department issued a fact sheet. This is from News and Views, you don't have to lose. Dick McManus sent it out. On December 19, 2002, the State Department issued a fact sheet in response to the Iraqi government's 25,000-page submission to the UN Security Council accounting for their entire weapons program. The State Department fact sheet directly cited the Niger yellow cake deals as proof that Saddam was lying to the UN. According to one well-placed career foreign service officer at the State Department, the inclusion of the Niger allegation was likely the work of the State Department's chief arms control official, John Bolton. The FBI has been investigating the forgery at the request of the Senate Intelligence Committee. A senior FBI official said that the possibility the documents were falsified by someone inside the American intelligence community had not been ruled out. He said, quote, somebody's hiding something and they're hiding it pretty well. End quote. John Bolton. The second day of the Bolton hearings was taken up with testimony by Carl Ford, the former head of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, INR, at the State Department. Ford, who resigned in late 2002, documented a string of instances in which Bolton abused intelligence analysts. The allegation that Iraq sought to obtain nuclear material, yellow cake, from an African country was first made publicly by the British government on September 24, 2002. A series of letters between Iraqi agents and officials in the central, blah, blah, blah. Note that the reported date the British made the fact known was prior to giving the documents to the U.S. And it goes on and on and on. You know, could it be that it was Bolton? Could it be that it was Bolton who fed the information to the British? I mean, there's a whole timeline here that really raises some serious questions about who was in charge of this and who did this and, you know, what was going on with the Office of Strategic Intelligence and all this. Was it John Bolton? At the same time, Ross Story. Yeah, RawStory.com publishes this. The word is out, they say. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee will not get the much-wanted National Security Agency intercepts, in which John Bolton expressed so much interest during his tenure as Undersecretary of State for International Security and Arms Control. Undersecretaries with questionable intelligence can get intentions can get the transcripts, but senators with constitutional oversight responsibilities cannot. Cannot. Dick Cheney and John Bolton's protectors are ever more committed to an imperial presidency unchallenged by other institutions of the U.S. government. Yeah. Here's the story. I mean, this is how it happened. The Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Richard Lugar, had asked for a copy of these NSA intercepts. John Bolton had asked the National Security Agency to intercept communications among certain people. Nobody knows exactly why. Could it be that they were people who were trying to verify the veracity of his claims about yellow cake? Could it be? You know, the I guess the could it be's are can be rather extensive here. But in any case, here's Bolton, a guy who is in a job where, you know, if once every 5 years you ask for an NSA intercept, it's a big deal. He gets 10 of them. And so the Senate, which is given, you know, the job of oversight on his confirmation, says, we'd like to see those. And these senators on this committee, they all have higher security ratings than John Bolton had. I mean, they're the ones who are overseeing the whole thing, right? They oversee the budget, they oversee the programs, everything. And they're saying, we'd like to see these documents. And Dick Cheney says, no. No. And so Richard Lugar, you know, he says, well, okay. He's going to be a good Republican. He's going to go along with it. And Chuck Hagel says he's going to be a good Republican. Now, on ABC's This Week, he says he has yet to learn anything that would keep him from supporting Bolton. Could it be because he hasn't learned anything yet? Could it be because the things that might inform him of that are being kept from him? Biden also sought records regarding Bolton's assertions that Cuba was bent on developing weapons of mass destruction and that China was exporting weapons technology. Bolton has been the State Department's arms control chief. The real issue here, said Joe Biden, the real issue here is how far did John Bolton stretch the truth or try to stretch the facts relating to intelligence? Well, sorry, Mr. Biden, but this administration is not going to tell you. They're not going to give you that information. They're not going to fill you, and you're never going to find out. This is the Bush-Cheney administration, after all. It's just like Dick Cheney's intelligence committee, counterterrorism task force. Dick Cheney was given two jobs when he came into office, be in charge of counterterrorism and prevent there from being a terrorist attack on the United States, track down Osama bin Laden, find out what these guys are up to, number one, and form an energy policy for the United States, number two. The energy policy, they met a whole bunch of times with all the big wigs from all the big oil companies, in private, in secret, and he went all the way to the Supreme Court to fight to keep those things secret, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't, it's the people's business. But, because we're the Republican Supreme Court, we'll let you hang on to that information until after the elections. And he's still hanging on to it. And his counterterrorism task force never met. Not until 9/11. Never met. And so we got hit. Yeah, they're doing a great job there. They're doing just a great job there. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Sick and tired of hearing things from outside, short-sighted, narrow-minded, little critics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Yeah, that's a plan. That's a good idea. A little bit of truth here. The Bush administration? No, I don't think so. You don't expect it. It ain't coming. It ain't going to happen. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, how are you?
I am great. I booked my tickets yesterday for the conference on June 1st through the 3rd. And so I think I will see you guys in Washington.
Oh, we're so glad. This is terrific.
Yeah.
It's going to be fascinating, I think.
Yeah. In fact, why don't you give a... You're familiar with the conference?
I am.
You want to give a little plug for it here?
No.
Okay, I'll do that some other time then, because I don't have the paper in front of me with all this stuff.
I don't have the paper in front of me. I don't want to give a false plug.
There you go. Well, we're going to have some fun anyway in the first week of June. So what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, it is a wonderful sunny day, and that actually is misleading. because behind the scenes, the clouds are gathering, particularly in the Senate, as people decide whether they're going nuclear, not going nuclear, and if they are they going to do it this week, next week, sometime, never. And everybody's counting heads. Moderate Republicans are desperately trying to hide so that they don't have to be counted one way or the other way and come out on one side or the other side. But it's inexorable that the clock's counting down, and it looks like one way or the other something will happen. Now, possibly not this week, but the posturing will continue this week by both sides, as particularly with the judicial nominees, for example, we'll see press conferences taking place to explain how wonderful they are or how terrible they are, and this really is looking to be quite a contentious week.
Interesting. What's your prediction?
I think that after Senator Chuck Hagel said over the weekend on one of the TV talk shows, basically said that he would not go with the nuclear option. I mean, he seemed to be indicating that it would be foolish to get rid of the filibuster. If they don't have if the Republicans don't have him, then they've got to hang on to everybody they can possibly hang on to, and then they have to start counting numbers like, you know, Senator Snowe, Senator Collins, and they're not definite by any means. I would think that it might behoove Frist to try and back off this, but I don't know how definite they are. I think it's too close to call, with me lurching ever so slightly towards it not going through.
Yeah, I'm of the opinion that no matter what, they've already won. That this is sort of like the ban on gay marriage constitutional amendment. You know, they get out there before the election and they whip up this thing. They have no intention of pushing it through. They, you know, in fact, they would rather not have it, because then they would have to, you know, everybody would recognize what essentially neo-fascists they are, you know, that they're not conservatives. That, you know, the old conservative notion of stay out of our bedrooms is like toast, right?
Oh, that's gone.
Yeah, so I think that, frankly, they're probably hoping that they don't have enough votes. In fact, they might even jerry-rig it in the background so that they are like one vote short, so that they can, and you know, blame it on Olympia Snowe or something. You know, pick on some poor moderate Republican that they just soon not have, and then they can forever blame those obstructionist Democrats, blame those radical Democrats, and yet at the same time they've got still more money coming in from the churches and the Christian fundamentalists, because they've played out they've done their passion play, they've played out the act.
Mm-hmm. You could well be right.
I think this is more about the theater than about the outcome.
Well, ultimately, it very often is in Washington, you know, and it's very difficult to. It's one of those things, though, where, you know, if you play chicken at the side of the road too many times, at some point someone's going to say, okay, then walk over.
Yeah, but just
right in front of the cars.
Just in the last 2 weeks, there's this group of evangelical pastors. Patriot pastors, they call themselves. They have grown from 2,000 to 5,000 churches in the last 2 weeks.
This is very scary stuff.
And they're doing it based on this filibuster thing. So, again, whether they win or lose, they win. That's the bottom line.
They win, and the nation becomes more divided.
Yes, which is their strategy. I mean, it's the Stalinist single-party rule strategy. You've got to divide the opposition in order to rule, particularly if you represent a minority viewpoint, and they do. Very few Americans actually believe in corporate rule and theocracy. Victoria Jones, thanks so much for the report from the Talk Radio News Service. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Great to have you with us. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Somebody just popped up a little private window off the chat room. When those happen, I've just got to instantly nuke them, because they cover up my call screen window. So to the folks in our chat room, please don't private message me. It's not that I don't want to hear from you. It's just that it covers up the part of my screen where I see if there's a phone call, and it's just not a good thing. So anyhow, welcome back to our program. House Resolution, or H.R., this bill before the House, H.R. 235. You heard about this? a little bit of danger, I would say. Danger to democracy. H.R. 235. You can find it at www.hr235.org. H.R. 235 was introduced to liberate clergy. To liberate clergy from the muzzle imposed by the absolute ban on all speech that may be regarded as political, and thereby enable them to speak out on all vital and moral and political questions of the day. It will free houses of worship from the fear and anxiety and uncertainty created by the threat that the IRS will impose financial penalties or invoked or revoke tax-exempt status altogether. Now, we made a deal with not just churches, but nonprofit organizations in general in this country way back when. I believe it was made during the Johnson administration, but I may be wrong. But in any case, we made a deal with them, and I'm not wrong about this. The deal was very straightforward. We said, we will agree with you that what you are doing is so important to democracy. It's so important to our way of life. It's so important to the future of America that we want to encourage it. We want to support it. We're even willing to subsidize it. We said this to nonprofit organizations like the Red Cross. You're giving blood to people. We will subsidize you. We said this to private schools. You're educating our children. We will subsidize you. How will we subsidize you? We'll subsidize you by you not having to pay for all the infrastructure that you're using. We will pay for it. You're not going to have to pay for the roads that people use to use your services. You're not going to have to pay for the rights of way that bring electricity to you. You're not going to have to pay for the rights of way that bring water to you. You're not going to have to pay for the rights of way that make the septic systems possible. You're not going to have to pay for the air traffic control system that allows you and your members to fly around the world. You're not going to have to pay for the police who protect your building. You're not going to have to pay for the fire department that protects your building. You're not going to have to pay for the schools that produce an educated populace who are using your services. We're going to subsidize all of that. You're not going to have to pay taxes. We will. Now, the one part of that deal that we would like you to keep is that if we're going to make that deal with you where you don't have to pay taxes, because taxes are a function of government. Taxes are, so, you know, only government can impose taxes. Taxes are a legislative thing. Then you stay out of politics. We'll exempt you from taxes. You exempt yourselves from politics. And so the Red Cross doesn't have an opinion about who should be president of the United States. The NAACP doesn't have an opinion about who should be president of the United States, although they're being investigated by the IRS right now because in one of their venues during the last election, somebody stood up and said something positive about John Kerry. And yet in pulpits, in churches all across the United States, from the pulpits, people were saying positive things about George W. Bush. No, there are no investigations going on, to the best of my knowledge. In fact, on this program, during the last election cycle, we actually were outing churches that had George Bush for president signs on tax-exempt property on their parsonages. Nobody did anything about it. Nobody did anything about it. So we had this deal with the nonprofits, with the churches, with the schools, with the communities for abused kids, with the blood banks. We had this deal with them. We'll subsidize you. Pat Robertson, we'll help you become a billionaire with all those donations you're getting from people. Just don't mess in politics. Because what you're doing, you know, the idea of supporting people in their religious endeavors, the idea of giving people some sense of peace in their lives, is so important. We're going to support that. And we're going to make sure that people don't abuse that. When I remember back in the 60s when the Universal Life Church came along. And you too can be a minister. $25. You can be, you know, join the Universal Life Church. And there were people who would do that, and then they would declare that their home was their parsonage. And the IRS had to come up with a whole new set of rules in the early 70s. that said that, okay, a church isn't a church just because you say it's a church. A church is a church if you have weekly services, if people attend who, you know, and they came up with this criteria for what is a church. And you don't involve yourself in politics. Because then it's not a church anymore, it's a political party. This is not rocket science. The American people, by and large, understand this. There is a massive subsidy in the United States. We're talking not just the $1 billion that George W. gave specifically to churches, largely black churches, during the last year before the election to get them to vote for George W. There is not just that $1 billion. I'm talking about tens of billions, perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars, certainly over the last decade, hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies that we have provided to churches, to religious broadcasting organizations, to ministries, radio ministries, television ministries. We give them absolute subsidy and support. We pay the taxes instead of them. And we say, all you have to do in exchange for this is not be political. Well, that's not enough for them. Now, nobody is saying to the churches, you can't be political. All we are saying is, if you want to be free of paying taxes like the rest of us, don't be political. I'm surprised, frankly. I mean, here we have this House bill, H.R. 235. Representative Walter Jones, Republican of North Carolina. You can call him if you'd like. His number is 1-877-SOB-USOB. Representative Walter Jones, Republican of North Carolina. A measure introduced by him would allow clergy to endorse candidates from the pulpit and still retain a tax exemption of their house of worship. And all you have to do, if you want to know where this is going, go to OhioRestorationProject.com. It's the website for the GOP's main plan for Ohio for next year, the 2006 election cycle. And right on their website it says, when the 2005-2006 cycle has been completed, our goal will have been accomplished. 2,000-plus Ohio pastors participating in 7 key pastor briefings, March through September. Christian Minutemen mailing list enlarged to 300,000 and 100,000 emails. 2,000-plus Ohio ministers become patriot pastors and attend major gathering in the fall of 2005. 30,000-plus Christians sharing in an Ohio for Jesus rally in early 2006. 4 million voter guides distributed in the fall of 2005 for first the May primaries in 2006 and then for November 2006. Video production and distribution of patriot pastors briefings for 7,497 Ohio pastors. It's a religious war on democracy. Make no mistake about it. Massachusetts was a theocracy before they joined the United States. It was one of the reasons why they almost didn't join the United States. Ben Franklin left Massachusetts in the early 1700s because they were hanging witches in the public square in Boston. And in fact, you find in the writings of Jefferson, and particularly Jefferson's writings, all this concern about Massachusetts. Massachusetts, after the United States was formed as a country, one of the biggest problems that Washington, Adams, and Jefferson dealt with was the fact that Massachusetts, the ministers in Massachusetts, tried to get that state to secede from the Union and go back to being a theocracy. They did not have tax-exempt status then, by the way. I think that there's a very simple solution to this. Very simple solution. We just say to the churches, fine, no problem. Start paying your taxes. Why isn't Jerry Falwell paying taxes? Why isn't Pat Robertson's organization paying taxes? Why isn't the Reverend Moon's organization paying taxes? They certainly have enough money. They've lost $1 billion in the Washington Times. Why don't we just say to them, hey, you know, pay your taxes. You want to get involved in politics? Fine. You're just another special interest group. You have to live by the same rules as any other political action committee. And you have to pay your taxes. What amazes me is that there hasn't been a proactive move on the part of liberals, progressives, Democrats, true conservative Republicans, in the House and Senate to end the exemption on taxes for churches. I mean, these guys are they're banging on the windows saying, "Hey, we want to play politics." You say, "Fine. You want to play politics, you pay to play." This is very straightforward. But no, they want to play politics and have you and me foot the bill and have us subsidize them. That's what this is all about. WorldNet Daily, the Reichwing website. An article posted on May 7th on Saturday. An Indiana congressman plans to curb the ACLU's appetite for filing lawsuits targeting religion in a public square by introducing a bill that denies plaintiff attorneys the right to collect attorney's fees in such cases. You get this? So the ACLU steps out and they say, "Hey, this church is violating the law by engaging in political activity, and we would like to hold them to account." So here now, Representative John Hostetler, Republican from Indiana. His telephone number is also 1-877-SOB-USOB. Congressman John Hostetler, Republican of Indiana, expected to file his measure next week to amend the Civil Rights Attorneys Fee Act of 1976 to prevent prevailing parties from being awarded attorney's fees in religious establishment cases. In other words, if you go after a church and you win, and they have to pay damages, the attorney cannot be paid out of that money. Now, how many lawyers do you think are going to take cases against churches if the law says they can't be paid? This is a religious war. What's amazing is, you know, I'm saying this, and I consider myself a religious person. I call myself a Christian. And yet it's so obvious to me that this is a religious war. And it doesn't represent all religions, and it doesn't represent all faiths, and it doesn't represent all people of faith. It represents a small right-wing crank bunch of essentially cultists within the Catholic Church and within some Protestant denominations who are willing to corrupt democracy, overthrow democracy, essentially, just to see their agenda, primarily about abortion, followed. Well, they've already made abortion unavailable to most women in the United States. You have large swaths of this country. There are no abortion clinics anymore left. The doctors have been murdered or driven out of business. They're not teaching how to do it in many of the medical schools. And then, of course, this weekend came the story. This kid, he's got a best-selling book, right? It's the New York Times. It's in the top 10 nonfiction bestsellers right now. And what did he do? He did a study. His last book was a study, which is included apparently in this book, pieces of this. He did a study of the relationship between the legalization of abortion and crime. And what he found was that when you decriminalize abortion and make it available safely and legally, that the crime rate goes down 10, 15, 20 years later. Time after time after time. Why would that be? Well, he said it's called the unwanted factor. If you have fewer unwanted children, you have fewer criminals, because unwanted children tend to grow up to be criminals. They're outcasts from the very beginning. I have a friend in Germany who is opposed to abortion. Very, very close friend of mine. And his response, the way that he dealt with his opposition to abortion, is he opened a home for pregnant mothers. And he said, "Hey, if you want to have a baby and have it be, you know, passed out for adoption, come here and we'll pay for your stay, and we'll take care of you, and we'll give you good prenatal care, and we'll make sure everything is fine, and we'll make sure that the adoption happens." Now, that's an appropriate response. And I'm sure that he prevented a lot of abortions from happening, which was his goal. But instead, to shoot abortion doctors or to pass, you know, to get right-wing crank judges in who are going to say, hey, we're going to take away a woman's right to make decisions over what's going on in her own body. This is just wrong. But this is the agenda of these folks because you know, with the morning after pill. I mean, it's been demonstrated now that the morning after pill does not cause an abortion. It does not stop the implantation of a fertilized ovum. Instead, it stops the ovum from even being released. And yet they're still opposing it. See, they're opposed not just to abortion, they're opposed to birth control as well. And that's driving 90% of this, I'm convinced. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 5 minutes before the hour. Oh, what a beautiful day it is, even though it's raining here in beautiful Portland, I believe. I haven't been outside in 5 hours, but it was raining this morning. Boy, was it raining this morning. Speaking of all, by the way, I just want to say, you know, for the record, I think sometimes it's important to say this because it's like, you know, so people know where you're coming from. I'm a husband. I'm a father. I am personally very, very ambivalent about abortion. I would think that, you know, if one of my daughters was considering an abortion, or if my wife was pregnant and was thinking about it, you know, my tendency, with my personal opinion, would be, you know, there's a real downside to it. Some women are just tortured by it for years. I mean, there's. And on the other hand, obviously, if there's health problems and things, I mean, there's an upside to it as well. But I would say broadly, you know, I don't think that it's necessarily always a good thing. In fact, probably usually not. But that's just my opinion. I'm a man. I shouldn't have an opinion on this topic in my, you know, lay it out. I mean, very straightforward. It's like we should allow women to vote on this. You know, should abortion be illegal or not? Sure, allow women to vote on that, but you know it's not going to affect me personally. So anyhow, that's my position, as it were, on it. I think that everything should be done that can possibly be done to minimize the number of abortions, and that means providing people with good sex education, providing people with good contraception, having a society where girls and women feel supported. And where they feel like they can say no to predatory boys and men and all that sort of, and at the same time say it's your choice, at least during the first 3 months and during the first 6 months. I mean, this was the Supreme Court ruling in 1973 that during the first 3 months it's just a piece of tissue. And during the second 3 months it's approaching viability, but, you know, in exceptional cases, it could be aborted. And in the third month, in the last 3 months, in the third trimester, no. And that's pretty much where the law stands right now in the United States. So anyhow, that's, I just, you know, to be on the record. But this is what is driving all of this. And they are so gung-ho about this because the churches all think that they're going to get an anti-abortion Supreme Court justice out of this. And that's why they're behind it. And what they don't realize is they're giving up democracy. They are ultimately harming themselves and their parishioners in the process by corrupting the democratic process. It's not good for America. And ultimately, it's not even good for the churches. It just adds more power to the Bushies and the corporatists. And that's why it's so terribly, terribly wrong what they're doing. Tom Hartman with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, blairosociety.org, Live 365's American FM, and in 29 states on cable systems on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Manuel Miranda. Manny Miranda served as counsel to Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. He's now chairman of the Coalition to End Judicial Filibusters and a visiting legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Before going to the Senate, Mr. Miranda served as national president of the Cardinal Newman Society for Catholic Education. Manny Miranda, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. Good to be with you and all your listeners.
Thank you. The move here to end the filibuster is really about this last part of your bio that I read, your affiliation with the Catholic Society, the Newman Society for Catholic Higher Education. Is it not? I mean, ultimately, this is really about abortion, isn't it?
Well, I think that both sides have pointed out that it's about abortion for quite a long time. I don't disagree with that at all. It is, of course, about a bunch of other things. There are other interest groups involved now. Environmentalists are involved. There are all kinds of groups that are now getting a sort of a piece of the pie. But the abortion issue is looms large on both sides, for both sides. And what the religious right, but really not even the Boyden Gray himself has make the argument that the abortion litmus test is in fact a surrogate for a constitutionally prohibited religious test. So a lot of things are tied up, and it is right for you to point out to the fact that I was once the head of a religious-based organization, but even people who are not a person of faith, someone who doesn't follow either Jewish or any faith, could understand that basically, when you go after someone's personal views, you're kind of inching a little bit into possibly affecting their religious conviction.
Manny Miranda, what did you mean when you said a ban on religion, accepted religions? That just flew right by me. What are you talking about?
Well, I don't know that I did say that. I think what I said was that the Constitution, Article 6, contains a prohibition that a religious test shall never be imposed upon nominees for public office.
Right.
And what they meant by that, those colorful cut-ups back in 1789, they really meant something like what had happened in England with the two test acts. In England, they adopted laws where they said someone who believes in transubstantiation, which is a fundamental view of Catholic theology, cannot hold public office. They never said Catholics cannot hold public office. They kind of got around that issue.
Right, transubstantiation being that the wafer and wine are the actual body and blood of Christ.
Exactly. And, you know, Episcopalians believe in consubstantiation, which is basically that these are mere symbols.
That they're meta to it, exactly.
Yeah, and they went after Baptists in very similar ways. They never said Baptists cannot hold public office. So what I'm saying and what folks have been saying is that the abortion litmus test is really...
But didn't that come out of the reign of Cromwell? I mean, didn't that come out of that era?
It did. It came out of the 1600s, the first test act.
Right, and Cromwell was running essentially a theocracy. I mean, the British, after 6 or 8 years, said, enough of this. You know, get this guy out of here. We want our king back.
Yeah, and that is, of course, a lot of people believe that secularism is nothing more than a form of theocracy. It's not the absence of religion. It's the replacement of religion. So it amounts to the same thing.
Interesting. Yeah, and I won't disagree with you on that, although I am going to disagree with you on this whole thing about the filibuster. Here we have, for example, Priscilla Owen, a candidate who I guess everybody figures, okay, she'll vote against abortion, so let's get her in there. But she has sided on many important cases on the side of big business against the individuals. She took money from Enron when she was ruling on a case about Enron. She took money from Halliburton when she was ruling on a case about Halliburton. Isn't there something wrong with this?
Not really, no, because most of our state courts are elected, and those judges have to raise their money somewhere.
But they recuse themselves.
They do, and she would have recused themselves.
She did not. She ruled her.
No. I said she would have recused herself if she thought that she had to. Remember that recusal is always left to the discretion of a judge. It's a judge's discretion to make that call. And she never had to recuse herself because she never felt that a mere $7,000 or whatever it is they gave her, a piddly amount, would have caused her to affect a ruling. I mean, that's really kind of unheard of to think that because Chuck Schumer takes money from Enron, but you don't have anybody say, well, he's defending Enron, because he takes money from Enron or whoever he takes money from.
So do you think that if somebody's just a little bit pregnant, they should they're not really pregnant and they should get an abortion?
I think in the case of judges, the practice has always been that a judge has to always determine whether if on the four corners of a case they have to recuse themselves, they need to make that call.
So Priscilla Owen can be a little bit corrupt, and that's okay, but if she was taking serious money, like Dick Cheney's $200,000 a year from Halliburton right now, then we'd have
a cause to say,
hey, wait a minute.
I don't think it's corruption to run a campaign, get elected judge, to go into public service, and basically not be influenced at all in any evident way because of her cases.
Well, she ruled in their favor.
Well, so maybe their case was the correct position. It means absolutely nothing.
Well, others on the court ruled against them.
Well, the point of fact is that many of her cases on business issues have been ruled on by a majority of the Texas court who didn't get Enron money as well as her, and many of those cases.
But that doesn't make it right. I mean, slavery was supported by a majority in the United States for a long time, too. That argument doesn't wash. I'm sorry.
It doesn't make it right were it to be well-founded, but the charge is ludicrous. Because a judge takes money for a campaign, it doesn't mean that she will sacrifice her career or be influenced in a decision. It is an unfounded, ludicrous charge.
Okay, well, here, Janice Rogers Brown has been right up, pretty outspoken and pretty upfront about the fact that she considers Social Security to be socialism, and that she would essentially rule the way the Supreme Court did back in the 19-teens when they said that, you know, child labor laws, minimum wage laws, the early attempt to have old age pensions, which later became Social Security, they struck all those things down as being unconstitutional. In fact, to quote her, she said, the New Deal inoculated the federal Constitution with a kind of underground collectivist mentality. The Constitution was transmuted into a significantly different document. 1937, the passage of Social Security, marks the triumph of our own socialist revolution.
Yeah, well, she's right. They don't call it securitism. They call it socialism. You know, Social Security is, and many of the New Deal legislation, brought us closer to a nationalist state. There was a nationalization of industries, and the courts ruled against many of the New Deal initiatives because of that very reason. They were unfounded in the Constitution.
Well, that's really funny. I look in the dictionary, and I find that socialism means that the government controls the means of production and supply.
No, that's communism and totalitarian communism at that. Most European countries.
Then how do you define socialism?
Well, socialism is a matter of degree. In Europe, for example, socialism is alive and well in almost every country, and much more so than in the United States. But there is no doubt that when statism, let's call it that, when people who believe that government should be involved in regulating business, regulating trade, regulating free markets, the more you get to a fuller control, a totalitarian control, well, that you're getting toward communism, but the road toward communism involves various shades of socialism, and there's no doubt that when the government got involved in any number of things in the 1930s, they were much like, you might say, the British government is now, which is fundamentally a socialist democracy.
So all of these socialist democracies of Europe have, in fact, all of the Western socialist democracies of Europe, you know, France, England, Germany, Denmark, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, Finland, on the list goes, Italy, all of them have lower poverty rates than we do, lower infant mortality rates than we do, lower crime rates than we do, higher quality of life than we do, longer lifespans than we do. Shouldn't we be saying, hey, maybe there's something to this socialism stuff?
Well, they also have less production, less creation of wealth.
Lower crime rates than we do, higher quality of life than we do, longer lifespans than we do. Shouldn't we be saying, hey, maybe there's something to this socialism stuff?
Well, they also have less production, less creation of wealth. They are fundamentally...
But they have less poverty. They may have fewer billionaires, but they have less poverty.
They have less people, too. They have less problems.
No, I'm talking as a percentage.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And if you take all of Europe, actually, there's more people than there are in the United States.
Well,
just by a few million, but...
You're dealing with states that selectively choose who comes in and out of their countries, whereas the United States basically, you know, is like a, I don't know how to describe it, but it is, let everybody come in.
Oh, tell that to the people in Haiti. I've been there. I've worked in Haiti. They would love to come here, and they get on a boat, and they come up here, they get arrested, they get dragged back down there.
Well, that happens to a lot of folks all over the Caribbean and the Dominican Republic as well, and in Mexico.
Right.
But
so,
the bottom line is that in Chile, in Sweden, they very selectively choose their immigration, so they have very little poverty for good reason.
So you're saying that poverty is caused by immigrants?
I think that when you have a, well, I'm not suggesting anything. I'm saying that what the Republicans are trying to do is to restore Senate tradition where there was never a filibuster used against a nominee with majority support. Never.
But well, other than Abe Fortas.
No, including Abe Fortas.
I'm that assuming that you read John Dean's debunking of Orrin Hatch.
I've read everything.
This is just published yesterday on Find Law.
Yeah, I have read. No, he has published that before. Actually, he published it about a year ago, but I have read everything, including Senator Griffin's own testimony on this very issue.
Okay, let me just give you that for a moment. I'll set aside John Dean and I'll say, okay, fine. And the reason why, and this is where I think you're being very disingenuous. I mean, 35% of Clinton's judicial nominees never got an opportunity to have a vote. The reason why is because they would send them to committee. And then the Democrats would say, hey, do we have enough here to override a filibuster? Do we have enough votes? Do we have 60 votes? And the Republicans would say, no, you don't. Or the Republicans and the Democrats together. I mean, you know, basically they would test the waters. And if they didn't have enough to deal with a filibuster, they didn't submit it. They didn't want to tie up Congress.
I disagree.
35% of Clinton's nominees never made it out of committee, whereas only 5% of Bush's nominees have failed to be confirmed.
Your numbers are wrong. Your numbers are wrong. 85% of Clinton's nominees as a whole got confirmed, and
and 95% of Bush's. What's he complaining about?
But the issue is the appellate court nominees, and President Bush has had only 7% confirmed. Look,
that the unemployment rate among federal judges right now is lower than the unemployment rate among average people.
Well, very luckily, because President Bush started much earlier than President Clinton to nominate people to the federal court.
And this is worth blowing up our Senate traditions over?
No, what is worth restoring Senate tradition for is when 10 and threatened more people are being blocked for no good reason other than their perceived ideology on a limited number of issues, really pandering to special interests.
Okay, Manuel Miranda. Former counsel to Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, now the chairman of the Coalition to End Judicial Filibusters, and a visiting legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Manny, a website?
You can go to any number, fairjudiciary.com or committeeforjustice.com.
Great. Thanks a lot, Manny,
Thank
for being
you,
with
Tom.
Us. I appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Is there a perfect storm coming that could drown the U.S. economy? We'll get into that a little bit later in the program. Alan in Oklahoma is on the line right now, however. Hey, Alan, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. Thanks for calling.
Yes, if I remember my history correctly, after Theodore Roosevelt left office, Taft came into office, and within, I think, 6 months, he turned everything over to the corporations.
By and large, yeah. Yes. And before Roosevelt, the corporations had been running the show, too. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt came into office. Well, he was, wasn't he McKinley's vice president? McKinley died?
I can't remember.
As I recall, I'm pretty sure it was McKinley who was assassinated, and Roosevelt became president.
Oh yeah,
and then,
I think
yeah.
so.
And then in 1901 or 1899 or whenever it was, right there at the turn of the century, and then Roosevelt got reelected. But the point is that Roosevelt had become this anti-corporate crusader. Certainly by the end of his presidency, he was gung ho there. And then when he tried to come back in 1913, 1914, and as I recall that election, he was trying to come back on the Bull Moose Party as a populist progressive. And didn't get it. I mean, he was sort of a Ross Perot candidate. He was significant. He altered the outcome of the election, but he didn't win. But in any case, yeah. So what's the point?
Prohibition was at that time too, wasn't it?
No, Prohibition came a little farther down the road, as I recall. I think that was in the 20s, but I may be wrong on the dates on Prohibition. I'm not a scholar of Prohibition. I'm sorry.
But it was before the Great Depression, right?
Yes. No, wait a minute. No, I don't know. I honestly don't remember. What I remember is my father telling me stories about being a kid during Prohibition, and so I think that must have been the 30s. But, frankly, I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm sure one of our listeners will correct us. Ah, somebody here in the chat room has it here. 1919 was, they just said, Zappa for President is 1919, but I'm not sure what he's talking about. Somebody knows when Prohibition began and ended, let us know. So, anyhow, what's your point, Alan?
I was just wondering if Prohibition went along with conservative politics.
Sure. I mean, and this is when they started going after pot and all these other things, too. I mean, there was, because we still have Prohibition. We've just only unprohibited one of multiple substances that alter consciousness and that have negative side effects, and we altered the Prohibition on probably one of the most dangerous, that being alcohol. But, yeah. So, anyhow, thanks a lot for the call, Alan. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Tom in Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted that interview you had with that right-winger was an excellent seminar and clinic on what this all boils down to, and it's the crux of this whole battle is down to one word, how you define democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, the folks in the chat room are telling me that Prohibition was from 1920 to 1933. So, anyhow, R.I.P., right.
Right.
Back to you, Tom.
Well, yeah, and so when you listen, and I've had this with my conservative relatives and friends, and this argument, all you have to do is pull out a Webster's Dictionary, take the word democracy and read it to them, what the true definition, ultimate power resides with the common people, and you read that, and they say, well, that sounds like socialism. You say, no, this is democracy,
right.
Man.
Right.
The people have the power to organize their own economic affairs. And just like you said, how Europe, they've decided to have regulated capitalism. He called it socialism, but it's actually regulated capitalism. They have the means to produce all the economic functions. They have private businesses. But their distorted definition of democracy is capitalism.
Yeah,
that's how they want to define the. So really,
exactly. They don't get it.
And so the word democracy is the battle. We cannot let them hijack this word democracy.
I absolutely agree. And I thought the other thing that was interesting was that he was right. He was perfectly comfortable saying yes. If we get these judges in, essentially saying yes, Social Security is socialism, and thereby implication.
Right.
And if we get these judges in, you can kiss your Social Security goodbye because we ain't going to have no more socialism in America,
regardless of what the people vote for.
Absolutely, yeah. Democracy
right.
be damned. This is about the right wing agenda and nothing
more. The
battle
is that one word.
There you go, democracy.
How to define it. Yeah.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Now for a traffic update, we go to Kelly Clark. Kelly, how's it looking out there?
Well, if you've got to get anywhere.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 27 minutes before the hour. This better be building to something. It's not. Welcome back. Oh, my. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to join us here on the program. And, in fact, John in Pennsylvania is on the line. Hey, John, your thoughts on the day?
Hello, Tom. I was directed to your program via the Internet,
this morning. You came up in a Google search that I did, and I clicked through, and I went to your homepage and to the live chat, and I got to tell you, you got some bitter, angry people on there, dude.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, my God. They, within 2 minutes, people were calling me names, cursing, typing, of course, cursing
yeah.
at me.
Yeah, well...
You got some bitter, angry people.
I am guessing that you said something that provoked them, because this is the first such comment I've heard in years, John.
Well,
certainly we've had conservatives go into the chat room before and disagree with people and have civil conversations. In fact, there's a number of them who are regularly in there and regularly participate on our message board. But if you're provoking people to cursing at you, I would wonder what you're up to, you know?
Well, I didn't provoke anybody. I made a statement, and they jumped.
Yeah, okay.
But at any rate...
So you wanted to talk about an issue, John?
Yeah, absolutely. Your last caller, you were talking about Social Security,
right.
Judges, et cetera, and at one point you said that Social Security would be gone if these judges got in, okay? To which your caller replied, regardless, he said, of the fact of what the people are voting for. Tom, when did we get to vote on Social Security?
When we elected the Roosevelt administration and the Democrats to Congress.
Incorrect. We never got a direct vote.
John, you don't understand representative democracy.
Sure,
We don't live in a pure democracy. Athens was the last pure democracy.
I understand
6,001 people in order for any law to be passed in the city of Athens, and because it was a pure democracy. We have a representative democracy. Obviously, I can say, John, when did we vote on having an income tax? When did we vote on having traffic lights? When did we vote on having fire departments? We obviously didn't vote on any of that. That is a bad rhetorical argument, John. The reality is that if you have something in place and it stays in place for 60 years, there's a fairly safe bet that the majority of the people think it should be there.
As one piece of an overall scheme. But for him to make the statement that we voted for something when nothing was voted for, you elected people.
John,
and
by your argument, we didn't vote for democracy. We didn't vote for we've never voted for anything. Come on, John, you're playing games with words.
No, he is.
Okay, what have we voted on, John?
What have we voted on? Well,
right.
I don't know what. Truthfully, I was.
Can you name one thing that we voted on?
35.
Can you name one thing that you voted on in your life?
Sure, I have.
Sure,
local issues all the time.
Okay, so you vote on local issues. One federal issue that you've voted on in your life?
None.
There's none, exactly. Because we have a representative democracy.
The Constitution does not provide for single issues at the national level.
That's right. Welcome to a republic.
Okay, now, where does the Constitution provide for Social Security at the federal level?
Where does the Constitution provide for traffic lights?
It doesn't. That's
where does it provide
issue.
For a national highway system?
It doesn't. So why do we have them?
Well, because as time went on, we decided that we're no longer in the horse and buggy era. We're no longer in the slave-holding era. We're no longer in the era where women can't vote. We're no longer in the area where women are the property of their husbands or the other men in their families. And so we need to update our laws to reflect the fact that times have changed.
Now you're attempting to throw emotion into it, though.
It's got nothing to do with emotion. This
slavery.
Is the reality.
You throw slavery and women's suffrage into it. You're throwing emotion into it.
The world was a very different place. No, I was trying to throw contrast into it, John. The world was a very different place in 1789 when the Constitution was ratified than it is today. And that's why from 1789 till today, we through our representative elected representatives, we have brought into being a whole lot of things that are appropriate to this day that weren't appropriate in 1789.
I don't see how Social Security is appropriate.
Well, for example, during the Great Depression, the leading cause of death among people over 60 years old was hunger or freezing. Most of the deaths of elderly people during that period of time, during the Great Depression, they were dying from lack of heat, lack of food. Poverty among people who were over 60 years old was over 60%, almost 70% during the Great Depression. And they were dying from lack of food and heat. And so we, the people, got together and said, we don't want our our parents and grandparents to be living this way and dying this way. What can we do about it? Well, let's create a program for old age pensions. Then we looked around and we said, oh, and by the way, there's also people like, you know, the father of a family who falls off a ladder and breaks his neck and he can never work again. And he's not like George W. Bush. He's not born with a trust fund. And so, you know, we should take care of him, too, because we want to live in a society where there are not beggars when you walk out of the street. I used to work and live in India. You walk out the street in India and there's snot-nosed kids with leprosy standing in front of your door with their hand out begging for food. We decided we don't want to live in that kind of a country. And so we decided we're going to take care of these folks. And we brought Social Security into being. And one-third of all the recipients of Social Security are not retired people. They are people who have had disasters in their lives. A good friend of mine, Michael, in Santa Fe, for example, he fell off a bridge. His neck is broken. He's living on Social Security. He's got nothing else. What are you going to do? You want him to live in the street with a begging bowl?
Tom, what about families?
What about families?
What about families, man?
Michael's parents are dead.
I would much rather that my parents come to me for help than go to a stranger.
Yeah, well, that's really sweet, John, and I'm sure that you can afford to pay for your parents.
No, I really can't.
Okay,
but
your parents are in trouble.
I would make it happen, though.
Yeah, well,
my parents are both dead, but that's neither.
The reality, John, is that in America, that didn't happen. People were dying, and Social Security cut the rate at which people were dying. It solved a serious social problem. You know, I understand that you'd rather billionaires and millionaires be able to have all they want and the middle class be damned and the working people be damned. But the bottom line is that we agreed in this society that if you play by the rules, if you work all your life and you play by the rules, that you should have a decent life. And that's, you know, that's just the bottom line. John, I got to move along. I'm sorry. The phone lines are all lit up. It's been a while here. Dana in Chicago on the line. Hey, Dana, what's up?
Well, hello, Tom. People may have been starving, but they did have alcohol.
Yeah, after 1933, right?
Correct.
So
from
what's
19,
up?
The Volstead Act went from 1919 to 1933.
Yeah.
So you were talking about it with your last caller, wondering what the time frame was.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Thank you. I appreciate that, Dana.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. No, thank you very much for the information. That's what you called for, right?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much for setting us straight. I do appreciate it. By the way, the question, where in the Constitution does it say we should have Social Security? I was kept hoping that my copy of the Constitution, which is in the next studio, that my assistant would run it over here, but I haven't. It hasn't happened. Here it comes. So my vague recollection was that there is, in the preamble to the Constitution, the reason why we created the Constitution in the first place, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And yes, that was dealt with early on. James Madison had to deal with the Congress had come up with a law to appropriate money to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor in Washington, D.C. And Madison vetoed that in 1812, saying it was his first veto, saying that this money should not go through churches, that the government should be providing it directly. Yes, we've had welfare in the United States since the beginning of this country in various forms. The government has been supporting it. We were supporting poorhouses in the United States in 1789. 1-866-889-8894. Ann in Sarasota. Hey, Ann.
Hi, Tom. Back in the other hour of the program, a gentleman went on and mentioned something about the how the Department of Justice is going after the Realtors Association, the National Association of Realtors.
Right, for antitrust. It's on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal.
Right, and I find that extremely amusing considering that the fact that the National Association of Realtors has been fighting tooth and nail to keep banking out of real estate. Because
so now the real agenda of the administration becomes apparent.
Yeah, because I'm a member of the National Association of Realtors and proud of it.
So the Justice Department is dancing to the tune of the banks, is that it?
Yeah, just like they did on the bankruptcy bill that now protects the credit card companies, not the individuals that get sucked into the high interest rate by the credit card companies.
Brilliant.
What
and you have given us the rest of the story. What they want to do. Go ahead. Finish.
All right. Well, what they want to do, basically, is they want to be able to offer real estate services so that they can put people in, hourly paid people, like $6-$8 an hour, to handle your real estate transactions with no training, no experience, no knowledge, not professional.
And no decent
salary. So that
they
can absorb. Right, and so they can absorb the extra money instead of letting professionals handle it. So that's what the big battle is about, and that's what this is all about. So Bush is backing banks taking away jobs from realtors.
So it's
another monopoly in the forming, not
yeah,
being
exactly
destroyed, forming another one.
Yeah,
okay?
another monopoly, and really it's a form. It's almost it's kind of like his union busting. I mean, if you look at the National Association of Realtors as a union. Or as a you know as a bunch of people who have a shared interest getting together, it's busting them up because they're willing to challenge the power structure of the banks.
Right, and by the way, we have a national code of ethics that we have to go by, and you can be disciplined, fined, and lose your license because of the code of ethics and be kicked out of the National Association of Realtors, and they do get kicked out.
Yeah.
So we do police our own, which is more than I can say for what's happening in the AMA and in the law field and banking and some of the other things that are going on, okay?
Yeah, the wealthier industries.
Right.
Interesting.
So
I wonder if this also might have something to do with the coming possible bust in the housing market, and they're trying to preposition themselves for that so that they can profit off that. But that's a whole other area of speculation.
Yeah, but they're not worried about us all of a sudden. They're just worried about us fighting them because we do have our own PAC that is fighting them on Capitol Hill, and we did beat them last round, so they're going for the jugular now.
That's interesting.
So I just thought I'd mention that to you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I have not yet read the entire article in the Wall Street Journal. I will read it through with that in mind and see how they deal with it. And thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Robert in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Great.
I just have a question for you. I think I might have heard it on your show. Is there some place in the Constitution that says the Pentagon should be audited?
No, it's not in the Constitution. What it says is that the Congress has oversight over the budgets of the executive branch, and the Department of Defense is part of the executive branch.
Okay.
So the Congress has the right to audit I'd have to go through and find it.
But, okay.
You know, it doesn't say that there shall be audits, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, it's possible that I'm wrong. I've read the Constitution. I don't represent myself as, you know, the penultimate constitutional scholar or anything.
Right.
But
I just have one other comment. All these people that want to get rid of Social Security.
Right.
What happened to honor your mother and father?
Well,
making sure they have a place to live. And
their argument is that their argument is that they're going to force us to honor our mothers and fathers by taking care of them. And what it misses is, what about those mothers and fathers who never had children? I guess they're not really mothers and fathers. What about those elderly people who don't have children?
Right.
You know, well, those are the exceptions to prove the rule.
Children have been killed. Or...
Yeah, or they should go to the church and beg for money. Their community should take care of them. I mean, it's unfortunately, you know, it's nice in principle. These are the big dreamers. You know, the libertarians, the Ayn Rand folks. You know, they have this grand vision of everything, and they think they've got it all figured out. And to them, I would quote Barry Goldwater. Of all people, he said, those who seek absolute power, even though they seek it to do what they regard as good, are simply demanding the right to enforce their own vision or version of heaven on earth. And let me remind you, they are the very ones who always create the most hellish tyrannies. Absolute power does corrupt, and those who seek it must be suspect and must be opposed. Barry Goldwater. So that's one of my favorite quotes. Anyway, Robert, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate
it.
1-866-889-8894. Sean in Indianapolis on the line. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, what's going on? Hey, you know, one thing that this guy that you just got off the phone with didn't bring up is an alternative to Social Security. And right now, I would love to work, but I actually have a disincentive to not work. I actually had no incentive to work because the system treats the poor better than the working poor.
Yeah.
And that's just insane. There's nothing I want to do more than work, but if I make over a certain amount, then I'm actually losing out.
Yeah, that disequilibrium, Sean, has been brought about by the fact that the minimum wage is no longer a living wage. I mean, that's the bottom line. If the minimum wage was a true living wage, if it was, say, a $10, $12, $14 an hour, as it actually is in some states, well, it's 7, 8, 9, 10. If the minimum wage is a true living wage, then people could make the transition from being on some sort of welfare program or on some sort of disability program into the workforce without going backwards. But, you know, that's not how it is. You're absolutely right, and it's an insane system.
And I know I have several legitimate disabilities, but that doesn't, you know, I mean, I get bored here all the time, and there's nothing that I want to do more than be a productive part of society.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of...
The system is set up right now, I mean, you actually hurt yourself if you stick your head above the gopher hole.
Yeah, well, let me remind you, Sean, I'm sure you know this, that there's lots of places where you can volunteer to work.
Oh, absolutely, and I do.
Yeah, okay. Good.
So, I volunteer for the Electronic Frontier Foundation and all that.
Yeah, great.
But, it's just to get experience. But I would love to be a contributing member instead of a taking member more than anything.
And I suspect that you reflect the opinions of most people who are the poor who want to become the working middle class. And
everybody my age.
There you go. And unfortunately, our system isn't set up to make that work. And, again, that's the cons and holding down the minimum wage. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, here it is. Come and get it. This is what the New York Times, Daniel Gross, the New York Times, is talking about. The Bushies and the cons out there might be bringing us in the process of bankrupting the government by cutting back dramatically on the funding to the government. Those are tax cuts for the millionaires and billionaires. Corporations now paying 16% of our national tax load instead of the 50% they were paying just 40 years ago. As the country becomes progressively poorer and poorer, as the middle class sinks deeper and deeper into debt, and as our jobs have been aggressively moved offshore, starting with the Reagan administration and you know, followed up by the Bush senior administration, then Bill Clinton really kicking the door wide open with NAFTA and GATT to sending our jobs overseas, and then George Bush Jr. coming along and saying, oh, this is really cool, embracing it. To the point where his syncopants in his Commerce Department are saying, yes, offshoring is actually a good thing. Everybody following the Tom Friedman model of the world. Yes, the world is flat. Sorry. You know, this is the debate Adam Smith was having. Go back and read Wealth of Nations. That was 1776, by the way. In any case, the Daniel Gross, the New York Times, suggests this could be the perfect storm that could drown the economy. He says that what we're seeing in the United States, the insane economic policies of the Bush administration, massive debt, massive spending, borrowing from our children and grandchildren, and borrowing in particular from overseas nations, $100 billion a year we're borrowing from the communist dictatorship of China, for example, putting us at their mercy. He says this could be a situation that could throw us into a crisis similar to that experienced by Mexico in 1994, Asia in 97, Russia in 98, Argentina in 2002. I remember traveling around Southeast Asia in 98, right after the meltdown of 97, and seeing all the office buildings that were half built, the cranes rusting in place. I remember traveling through Russia, through Kaliningrad in 98, 99, after that debacle. I remember being in Argentina in 2003. We don't want that here. But if the Bush administration continues the way they're going, and we don't get some fiscal sanity in this country, that's what we're going to end up with. It's a good time to start working for political change. And let's get some real statesmen back into office. This goes beyond Republican and Democrat. This goes to the economic health and well-being of our nation. Tom Hartman here with you. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vivionik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that